the headlines this hour. UN spokesperson says delivering aid to quaking regions in northern Syria has been hampered by a terrorist group that controls that region. Israel launches airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip as more Palestinians fall victim to regime violence in the occupied West Bank. And the U.S. military shoots down another unidentified flying object near the Canadian border, making it the third such shootdown in as many days. This is News. Thanks for joining us. It's 7 days since a powerful earthquake hit Turkey and Syria, and the death toll keeps rising. Over 33,000 people have so far been confirmed dead in the two countries. Officials say that some 29,600 people have been killed in Turkey. At least 3,600 also lost their lives in Syria. Rescue workers continue to scour neighborhoods despite freezing weather. Experts, however, are cautioning that hopes for finding people alive are growing slimmer with each passing day. The UN says a terrorist group in control of a part of quake-hit northern Syria is hampering the transfer of aid by the Syrian government. Spokesperson for the UN Humanitarian Aid Office says aid deliveries are held up over approval issues by the terror group known as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. The revelation comes as concerns are growing over the situation a week after two powerful earthquakes rocked the adjoining border regions of Turkey and Syria. Most deaths and injuries from the earthquakes in Syria have been reported in the territory held by terrorist groups. Meanwhile, UNAID Chief Martin Griffiths lamented the failure of sending desperately needed aid to the quake-ravaged Arab country, saying that people there feel abandoned. Griffiths also painted a grim picture of the situation in both Syria and Turkey, saying the current death toll is expected to double or more. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, says the terrorist activity in the quake-hit areas indicates a lack of concern for the well-being of people.
This is another proof that those are terrorists. They don't care about the people. They care only about their interests. And what we know is that the so-called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, also known as the Al-Nusra Front, said that it will not allow aid shipments from government-held parts coming from government-held parts of Syria, and that they believe that the aid will be coming or should be coming from Turkey. This is how the terrorists of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham think. Obviously, they're politicizing the issue over here, over a humanitarian situation, because they said we will not allow the government to take advantage of the situation and show that they are helping, as they said. So definitely, this is bad news for the people, for the civilians, for those affected. And once again, unfortunately, this is the result of all of the support that the United States and its Western allies have been giving to such terrorist groups inside Syria. This is the result that we're seeing on the ground. Unfortunately, now they are controlling the areas. They are not allowing the aid to come now to the civilians. And definitely those suffering the most are the people, the ordinary people that have been affected by this earthquake.
At least 30 Palestinians are injured as Israeli forces storm a residential area in the occupied Al-Quds to destroy a Palestinian home. The injuries were the result of clashes that erupted between the local residents and Israeli forces. For more on that, we are now joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil. Mona, what do you have for us?
Well, Israeli forces this morning raided the Jabal al-Mukabbir area in East Al-Quds in order to destroy a house owned by the al-Bashir family in Al-Quds. Of course, Israeli forces, before destroying the home, surrounded the area and prevented the people, residents of this house to come close. Clashes erupted, and as you have mentioned, we are speaking about 30 Palestinians were wounded. At least 25 of them were shot by rubber-coated bullets. The reasons for destroying the homes, we have to mention that the Israeli Al-Quds municipality informed the residents of Jabal al-Mukabbir that five Palestinian homes would be destroyed for not getting Israeli-issued building permits. Palestinians living in Al-Quds, it's not easy for them to get the needed and required building permits, because at the end of the day, the Israelis want for the Palestinian residents of Al-Quds to leave the area. At the same time, they give green light and approve construction for the Israeli settlers who are living illegally there and building illegal homes on the Palestinian lands, of course.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. From occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil. Well, several explosions have rocked the Gaza Strip as Israel carries out airstrikes in the besieged Palestinian territory. Regime warplanes conducted 10 raids on the west of Gaza, targeting an underground site used by the resistance movement Hamas. The Israeli military also pounded a Hamas site in central Gaza. There are no reports of possible casualties. The airstrikes followed what Israel claimed its shooting down of a rocket fired from Gaza over the weekend. There was no Palestinian claim for that launch, but Israel has conducted aerial and ground attacks, citing similar pretexts in the past. Meanwhile, more Israeli atrocities in the occupied West Bank. Regime forces have killed a Palestinian during a pre-dawn raid in Nablus. Troopers also injured six Palestinians during the incursion. In reaction, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said Israeli hostilities are doomed to fail thanks to the heroic resistance of Palestinians. On Sunday, regime troops shot dead a 14-year-old boy in the flashpoint city of Jenin. Israeli forces regularly carry out deadly raids in the West Bank under the pretext of detaining Palestinians. Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians, killing around 50 people in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year. Political commentator Syed Nimr says Palestinians need to escalate their resistance in the face of Israeli crimes.
Generally speaking, the Israelis, they don't care and they don't differentiate between the Palestinians, and they kill anyone in front of them. It's so easy for them to kill because from their perspective, they dehumanize the Palestinians, so, and they have a government that says that we are not going to bring any soldier or settler to a court if they kill the Palestinians. And usually they have the excuse for that, and they have the, if you like, the justification, saying that the Palestinians try to attack us or they have a knife or something like that, and they, that makes it very easy for them to kill the Palestinians. The Palestinians need to escalate their own resistance to against the settlers and against the Israeli army in the roads, which now became controlled by the settlers. So we need to regain our control over our roads and to start, you know, targeting the settlers in all these roads, so to bring them back to where they used to be during the first intifada and the second intifada, when they couldn't move on our roads without a convoy of Israeli army. This is on the one hand to escalate the resistance against the occupation.
Australia has released a plan to address what authorities are recognizing as the indigenous disadvantage. The plan marks the 15th anniversary of the government's apology for the forcible removal of indigenous children from their families. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has also announced around $300 million in funding to improve the lives of the Aboriginal people. Australia's constitution makes no mention of the roughly 1 million indigenous population of the country or their rights. The Aboriginals fall well below national averages on most socioeconomic measures. Cases of suicide, domestic violence, and imprisonment are also disproportionately high among the population. U.S. military has shot down an unidentified flying object, this time over Lake Huron in the state of Michigan. This is the third object intercepted in the U.S. skies in the last 3 days. Pentagon spokesperson said the object, traveling at an altitude of 20,000 feet, was shot down by fighter jet upon a presidential order. Patrick Ryder said the object might have had surveillance activities, as it was detected near sensitive military sites, but posed no threat to them. A Canadian team has begun searching for the wreckage of the object that was shut down on Saturday. American authorities have not specified the details of the three objects detected on radars. Recently, the U.S. also shut down what it called a Chinese spy balloon that had entered American airspace. Beijing slammed the U.S. move as an overreaction, saying the balloon was a civilian meteorological airship that had been blown off course. Ukraine's Western allies are looking at more effective ways to arm the country. The UK is considering plans to set up factories in Ukraine to manufacture weapons and vehicles. British media say the country's defense industry officials are in Ukraine to discuss plans to set up joint ventures to manufacture arms under license. The reports say producers from other European countries are also in similar discussions with Ukraine. Earlier this week, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky traveled to London and to Paris to appeal for more Western arms, including fighter jets and heavy long-range weapons. Britain this week announced a plan to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly NATO standard warplanes. Now Poland says giving F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine requires a consensus among allies. Russia's embassy in Britain has warned that any delivery of British fighter jets to Ukraine would have serious military and political ramifications. Washington's military support for Ukraine has always been a heated debate in the U.S. Congress ever since the war broke out between Moscow and Kiev. Many have called for an immediate halt to such a support and are urging warring sides to negotiate a ceasefire.
The Russia-Ukraine war is about to enter its first anniversary within days. So far, thousands of people have been killed and many more displaced. Now, after nearly 1 year, the war has turned into a bigger conflict, an encounter, rather, between the West and Russia. Many countries, including the U.S., Germany, France, and the U.K., have been fanning the flames of the conflict by sending military aids worth billions of dollars. In the U.S., there has been a long debate among politicians on whether to support Kiev in its war with Russia. Some back the U.S. support for Ukraine. Others, however, take a different stance. Among them is Congressman Matt Gaetz. The Republican lawmaker has introduced a bill which calls for an immediate end to U.S. military and financial support for Ukraine. The resolution also urges the warring sides to negotiate a ceasefire.
How much more for Ukraine? Is there any limit? Which billionth dollar really kicks in the door? Which red line we set will we not later cross?
Throughout the war, Gaetz has been critical of U.S. support for Ukraine and has previously called for an end to the policy.
I will not vote for one more dollar to Ukraine. I will not vote for one more piece of materiel to Ukraine. We are far too entangled in this conflict. I believe we have extended this conflict. And I call on the Secretary of Defense to declassify the Inspector General report on the compliance with our existing regulations regarding chain of custody with materiel going to another country.
Gaetz has also taken a jab at President Joe Biden. In a statement on his resolution, Gaetz said President Joe Biden must have forgotten his prediction from March 2022, suggesting that arming Ukraine with military equipment will escalate the conflict to World War III. He added America is in a state of managed decline, and it will exacerbate if we continue to hemorrhage taxpayer dollars toward a foreign war. We must suspend all foreign aid for the war in Ukraine and demand that all combatants in this conflict reach a peace agreement immediately. Gaetz's resolution has so far received 10 co-sponsors, including Andy Biggs from Arizona, Lauren Boebert from Colorado, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, Anna Paulina Luna from Florida, Thomas Massey from Kentucky, and Mary Miller from Illinois.
The U.S. fiscal budget for 2023 includes more than $800 billion for military purposes. Many in the U.S. argue that a big portion of that money, which consists of sending military hardware to Ukraine, could be allocated to fulfill other essential needs, including health care and education.
The bill introduced by Gaetz notes that the U.S. has already authorized over $110 billion to spend on the war in less than a year. The resolution comes after a series of escalations of U.S. military aid, including M1 Abrams tanks. It also comes at a time when Ukraine is seeking fighter jets from the U.S. and its allies. Each escalation risks a direct clash between Russia and NATO, which could quickly spiral into a nuclear war. But where does this rising U.S. opposition to continue aid to Ukraine come from? If U.S. taxpayers knew that half the income tax dollars that they sent to the Internal Revenue Service every year was being spent on weapons, war, and war preparation, political support for such programs might significantly decline. As a matter of fact, no agency of the federal government communicates to taxpayers how Congress spends their money. Purchasing weapons and military services with taxpayer dollars has always been, and continues to be, a highly profitable endeavor for defense contractors. But it is in a real war, like as in Ukraine, that such profiteering truly thrives. President Joe Biden's budget proposal to Congress for 2023 included $813 billion for the Pentagon and military expenditures. This is more than half the income taxes citizens send to the federal government each year, and a more than $31 billion increase over the already bloated fiscal year 2022 Pentagon budget. It is also more than the defense budgets of the 8 next biggest military spenders put together, including Russia, China, and India. One of the components of the $782 billion Pentagon budget is for the purchase of new nuclear-armed submarines, even though the U.S. already has 14 lethal Ohio-class submarines, each capable of launching 192 nuclear warheads. Canceling two of these unnecessary and provocative new weapon systems would save more than $10 billion. All in all, what seems to be a non-negotiable is the U.S. taxpayers' money, which could and can be allocated to other needs. What seems to be clear, not only to American taxpayers, but to the whole world, is that the U.S. military-industrial complex is the only one who benefits most from such aid.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I'm now in Yazd province. Which city in this province? Mehriz city. I'm going to visit a beautiful historical caravanserai in Mehriz. Zeynuddin Caravanserai. I'm going to stay here at night and watch the stars in the sky of the desert. There is a 400-year history behind this caravanserai. Well, here I arrive. The tranquility and the silence of the desert where the caravanserai is located, the delight of watching the sunrise and sunset from the top of the building, where nothing disturbs the view, and the historical value of the caravanserai are the reasons why staying at Zainuddin Caravanserai is a highly recommended experience in Iran. So let's head to this historical caravanserai. Zainuddin Caravanserai is a magnificent caravanserai located in the heart of the desert in Yazd province, 60 kilometers from the city of Yazd. This monument is one of the most famous caravanserais of Iran, which is still in use as a unique accommodation for travelers. Zainuddin Caravanserai was built during the Safavid era. The inn is in a completely different and traditional style and is now capable of accommodating hundreds of guests and tourists. For your information, caravanserais were roadside inns where travelers and caravans used to take a rest and spend the night after a day's journey, communicate with other travelers, and even trade some goods. Historical caravanserais of Iran, which hold many stories from the guests who spent a night and continued their journey the day after, are spread all over this country, especially on the Silk Road route, which passed through Iran and connected China to the west. Caravanserais, which are usually constructed with adobes and earth, are rectangular areas with a central courtyard surrounded by small rooms for accommodation. As we step into the middle of this year's cold winter, the weather gets mild and pleasant in southern provinces of Iran. That is why I usually take trips to the south in cold seasons. Anyway, let me tell you something. This caravanserai, besides being a historical monument, is a number one hotel at the heart of the desert. I have heard that international travel and tourism magazines have put the name of this caravanserai in the list of their best hotels in the world. And something else. Zainuddin Caravanserai got reconstructed about 20 years ago and received the prize of the best reconstruction from UNESCO in 2006. The room I have booked in this hotel is extraordinary. Here, there is everything you can have in a modern hotel. The only difference is that everything here is traditional. What a great thing is to be here! And now that I have been accommodated and moved my luggage, I prefer to take a tour around this caravanserai. A good idea. Exactly where every lover of historical monuments wants to see. You can even stay here at night. Wonderful! Zainuddin is one of the most unique caravanserais in Iran, and that is because of its architectural plan, which shows a circular building from outside and a dodecagon shape from inside. This structure is built by bricks, and the entrance of the rooms around the central courtyard are ornamented with well-formed arches. After passing the entrance gate, on the south of the building and the hashti, which is the vestibule or a small space leading to a larger space, you will enter the round space, which is originally a dodecagon surrounded by brick-made porticos leading to the small rooms where travelers stay. Beautiful. The hashti, or the vestibule, is continued by two long corridors that pass behind the rooms. Guess what? These corridors were used as horse stables. The room on the north side of the caravanserai was the shahnishin, a room used by the kings and governors, which is characterized by its high ceiling and ornaments, including stucco works. Very beautiful. This building is fenced by five brick towers that are attached to the 8-meter-high walls, which has resulted in a unique shape of architectural plan. As I said earlier, Zainuddin Caravanserai is renovated and is used as a wonderful inn or desert hotel in Iran with capacity for 100 travelers. Oh, I'm very hungry. time for dinner. In this Iranian traditional environment, eating Iranian food, kebab and doogh. I wish you were here. It was very delicious. Well, I finished my dinner. It's dark outside and the only thing I need is going to the roof and watch the stars. On two sides of the caravanserai, there are stairs that lead to the roof. Oh my God! It's desert as far as the eye can see. Oh, I feel great. The stars are so near that you feel you can catch them by your hands. I really enjoy being here. And tonight, I sleep in a room which has brick walls and its bed sheets are decorated with Iranian traditional clothes. And if you're interested in deserts of Iran and amazing experiences like staying at a caravanserai for a couple of nights and enjoying the beauties of desert, take a tour to Yazd province and have a memorable experience at Zainuddin Caravanserai. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Russia is calling for an emergency meeting to be held by NATO regarding the September 26, 2022 explosions of the Nord Stream gas pipelines. Now, this after renowned American journalist Seymour Hersh has written that the United States is responsible for the explosions. Now, he said that U.S. President Joe Biden gave the order and the American Navy divers put explosives on the pipelines under the cover of NATO war games held in the region. Now, even though this information is quite explosive, mainstream media is either ignoring the bombshell altogether or downplaying it. But the ramifications of this revelation may play a major role or the restructuring of the unipolar world. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels. And Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst out of Raleigh, North Carolina.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me on the program. I'll start this off with Gilbert out of Brussels. Your assessment of Hirsch's revelation, I mean, do you think that his accusations will be followed up by American officials or journalists?
Well, my personal opinion here is not a great consequence. I would like to use this opportunity to confirm that I have received today from two sources who are authoritative, very respectable, and well-informed about the career of Seymour Hersh, who have written to me and to others that they have great confidence in the veracity and in the comprehensive truths that Hersh has presented on his website a couple of days ago. One of these is a retired U.S. diplomat with a distinguished career, who was in his later posts the ambassador to one of the major countries in the Middle East. He has confirmed to me and to several others the integrity of Hirsch, his understanding that Hirsch's exposés of various abuses by the U.S. government going back decades were always well-founded and well-presented, and that Hirsch has been the vehicle for bringing these abuses to the public precisely because those who divulged what they knew, and these are people in the administration of Joe Biden, they understood his ability to protect his sources and the persuasiveness and authority that he would bring to the publication of these materials. The second confirmation comes from an equally authoritative and valuable source from a different field completely. That is a professor of law at the University of Illinois who wrote to me that going back to 1969, he was greatly impressed by Hirsch's exposés on the U.S. biological warfare programs. The man involved, the lawyer involved, is himself became the drafter of the implementation legislation that was introduced and passed in Congress in 1989-1990, implementing the General Convention on prohibiting biological weapons. So his personal experience and knowledge of Hirsch going back to 1969 was later confirmed by many other exposés, the My Lai massacre and the Abu Ghraib torture to span several decades of investigative reporting which was signed by Seymour Hersh. For these reasons, we welcome the Russian initiative to bring Hersh and other journalists' material mm-hmm. about this war crime to the attention of NATO and to other international institutions.
Okay. Stay with me, Gilbert. Let me get Ray in on this. Well, I mean, listening to what our guest in Brussels said, basically, he's saying that from what others or people who are quite reputable are saying, that this is quite likely, quite possibly to be the truth. So, Ray, my question to you is, why aren't we seeing this bombshell explode in mainstream media and talking about this? This is a war crime. What's going on, Ray?
Well, I could profess to be shocked, but it's par for the course. And everything that Dr. Doctora has just said is true about Cy Hersh. So despite all that, or actually because of his reputation for veracity and for protecting his sources, the U.S. media won't touch it in any real way. Now, it speaks volumes, and this is perhaps as equally important of the aspect of the story. Cy Hersh wrote for the New York Times, got Pulitzer Prize, got five other kinds of Polk Awards, and then he wrote for the New Yorker magazine, and then he wrote for the New York Review of Books and the London Review of Books, and the last expose he had to write for Die Welt, a German newspaper whom he had a contact. Now he has to publish on his own Substack. My God, that speaks volumes. Now, the question is, will this Substack, and I am confident, I know now that Hersh's thing has been translated into German, will the Germans look at it, and will they will they download that clip which shows Olaf Scholz standing next to Joe Biden when Joe Biden says, we will end Nord Stream 2, and Scholz looks on, and he's asked, what about this? And he said, well, we do everything together. Together, we do everything. Will the German people ask Olaf Scholz now and his Bayerbock deputy, foreign minister, will they ask him, did you do this together, Olaf? Or was this a surprise to you that the United States did it? That the United States did it is a no-brainer, let's face it.
Right. Well, you know, you brought up an interesting point, Ray, about the Germans. Dr. I'd like to get your perspective on that because, I mean, it's quite amazing in some ways when we look at the ramifications of all of this, what happened to begin with and how it has affected the Germans and other European countries. And, of course, basically officials being part of the American hegemony, just going along with it. Do you think that this will backfire? Do you think that the Europeans, at least if not Americans, but Europeans will actually demand some answers? Because Russia is demanding that NATO investigates this and hold those accountable, responsible. But your perspective on that?
I'm sitting in Belgium, and I was just looking today at our newspapers, surprised, again, in the sense that that Ray had it. There's not a word about Cy Hersh. There's not a word about his expose of the explosions. So the European, and I look at the French newspapers, they are quiet. They are no more involved, no more forthcoming than American media. There's no surprise there either, because for years now, European newspapers and media have taken their cues from Washington, D.C. Still in all, there is hope that there's some slow glacial movement in Europe and even in Germany will bring attention to this. I was very pleased to see today that there is finally a left-right agreement in Germany between on the Die Linke with their leader Sacher Wagenknecht and with representatives of the Alternative for Deutschland to issue a manifesto for peace and to stage a demonstration at the Brandenburg Gate on the 25th of February, calling upon Chancellor Scholz to stop the shipments of heavy weapons to Ukraine and instead to take an active role in calling for peace negotiations. This is a small chink in the ice, but it is worth noting, and it has let us hope that more than a symbolic number of people turn out at Brandenburg Gate.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Your overall assessment, I mean, we're seeing a full-out attack on Russia. I mean, the Nord Stream explosions, obviously, this is one part of it. We continue to see the NATO expansion towards Russia until basically Moscow had no choice but to deal with Ukraine in the way it is. Do you see everything that the United States and its allies that have done basically has now backed itself in the corner? Because it seems like, I mean, with the economic sanctions that they have targeted Moscow with, basically, Russia is back to where it was at the start of the war when we look at it from an economic perspective and starting to expand other relations. I mean, your overall assessment of this, has the U.S. backed itself in the corner?
Well, the U.S. has isolated itself. You talked earlier on, or you mentioned the bipolar or the multipolar world, was your phrase. I see it as bipolar, not only in the psychiatric sense, but in the realpolitik sense. It's the lily white West against people of color who represent 80% of the rest of the world and Russia. Russia has been blackened to the point where it's people of color as well. So what we have is a new correlation of forces. The problem is that the people who are running U.S. foreign policy are from the elite schools where they learn that the U.S. is exceptional. Now, they believe that. I mean, they think that the U.S. can just throw its weight around. This started 2 years ago when the U.S., when Blinken and Blinken and Sullivan read the Riot Act to China, saying you got to obey the new rules-based order that we make the rules on. And it's continued right down. The problem is that we all know what's going to happen in the next couple of months. I'm convinced that Russia is going to move as far west as they will without some indication of real bona fide negotiations on part of the U.S., in Ukraine, I'm talking, of course. And then the decision will be, well, were we wrong? Are we no longer exceptional? Or do we have to raise the ante still more and threaten the use, God forbid, of nuclear weapons? Nuclear weapons will not be a threat from the Russians. They don't need them in Ukraine. We will have people arguing that, yeah, maybe just a little tactical nuclear weapon might come in handy at this point. That's the danger.
Mm. Well, we look at, Dr. O, also Russian expansion. We look at its influence over more and more African countries, where it seems that the U.S. and its allies are losing more and more of its influence, whether we're talking about Northern Africa, South Africa, Mali, Burkina Faso. Tell me how do you see this, assess all of this, that more and more countries are leaning towards the Big Bear than the Stars and Stripe, and Washington's reaction to all of this?
Well, it's more than just Russian initiative. It's an American withdrawal. The two things have gone hand in hand. Yes, the Russians have been very keen to sign up more and more countries to at least abstain and hopefully vote their way in various contentious votes in the United Nations and in other global fora. They have had a lot of success. Some of this is maybe attributed to the remarkable successes of the Wagner private military company, which has been working in precisely the areas that you've just mentioned, and has proven itself to be a more valuable ally to the governments in holding peace than the French or other former colonial powers who have been displaced by the Russian entry. But I think we're really, first of all, looking at nose counting. Secondly, we're looking at the Russians changing their foreign policy from what it had been in the Soviet period. I was present a few years ago at a meeting in Moscow of parliamentarians, to which a number of African countries had been invited. And the head of the Communist Party of the Russian Federation was present at this reception party, and it was glowing, as if the good old days of the Soviet Union were coming back. No, they're not coming back. The Russian Federation is a very different entity with a very different set of principles for governing very efficiently and for managing foreign policy in a way that is constructive and not destructive of Russia's finances. In the past, Russia had given out a lot of financial aid and military aid and received little or nothing back. That's the Soviet period. That's gone. The Russians are playing an American game now in making foreign policy a contributor to their net wealth rather than a loss of their net wealth. And this pertains to their activities in Africa, where they have been very keenly tying in military support and like the Wagner Group with contracts that they conclude in the mineral extraction industries and other wealth of these countries that formerly was in the hands of the colonial overlords.
Well, Ray, we also see expansion with Russia with these various alliances they have, such as BRICS or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and these countries involved in that, and also looking for alternative banking system, international system. Your assessment of that, and where do you think this is going?
Well, the bilateral agreements now between Russia and China, Russia and Iran, Russia and many other countries sound the death knell for the primacy of the dollar in international trade. Again, the economists advising Biden don't seem to be any brighter than the ones advising him on foreign policy. So that's the big change. I would say that China has to be emphasized here, because there has been a tectonic change in what the Russians used to call the world correlation of forces, and that is that we have Russia and China now in a virtual alliance which has no upper end, read military alliance if it comes to that. That's a marked change. And mark my words, that if there's a dust-up, if there's a armed conflict in Europe, involving Russia and the West, you can expect lots of trouble, armed trouble, in the South China or the East China Sea or maybe even the Taiwan Straits. Now, that's what the U.S. policymakers, bright as they pretend to be, have gotten the U.S. into, and it's a no-win situation. You just don't go two against one, and the one is the United States now, and it's got the short end of this isosceles triangle.
What does that mean, Dr. Doctorow? You heard Ray McGovern say about the alliance, growing alliance between China and Russia. As he talked about the advisors to Biden, what is it? Is it the fact that the United States cannot accept a multipolar world, them not being on top, or if they can't lead, they don't care if the whole thing is destroyed? I mean, your assessment of this, obviously there should be some people advising against what they're doing.
The people who are advising against what they're doing are like Ray and myself in a dissident status outside the inner circles of power. I think you've rightly touched on the de-dollarization as one of the most significant developments in the last year. And the wars are measured by tanks and men on the ground and artillery pieces. That is a traditional and very easy to understand aspect of war. But since the very beginning of the Russian special military operation, when the United States froze, or shall we say confiscated, $350 billion of Russian reserves, the economic dimension of the war has been hard to miss. And that pertains to all aspects. The well-known doyen of the realist school of foreign relations in the United States, John Mearsheimer, was saying maybe 6 months ago, that explaining what the overall situation was in this conflict, that for Russia, the war is an existential war for its existence, whereas for the United States, this was an optional war that it could walk away from at any time. I have just read an analysis, which I found very persuasive, from a French historian, arguing that the war is now existential for the United States as well, precisely because the American means of maintaining its global hegemony, the financial weaponization of the dollar as a reserve currency, has been put in jeopardy. And if the Russians win on the ground, which appears to be the case, the Russians are also winning on the financial dimension in combination with Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, India, Iran, and China. It's not just China. There is a whole constellation of countries that have joined the United States, joined Russia rather, quite willingly in a de-dollarization move.
Okay.
And that is in the most important commodity on earth.
All right. And on that note, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. I appreciate it. Very interesting discussion from both of you. Out of Brussels, Dr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, and out of Raleigh, North Carolina, former CIA analyst, Mr. Ray McGovern. A pleasure having both of you. And with that, that brings us to the end of this Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have a very special guest speaker for today's discussion, Shaykh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Shaykh, one of the most controversial questions for people all around the world, even some Muslims may pose this question, is that why, for example, Salat is in Arabic language, or is it at all necessary to read the Holy Quran in the Arabic language? Why so much focus on this language in order to be connected to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, to get connected to Allah